2003 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 232. A foreign message? Why do Black Americans react differently to the church than do Black Africans? A panel featuring Ken Driggs, Renee Olson, Ted Withers, and Natalie Palmer Shepherd.
Other members of our panel are two people that I'm fortunate to know from Atlanta, where I'm from. Renee Olson is a member of the Glen Ridge Ward of the Atlanta Stake. She's been a member of the church since 1996. She is a recovering Baptist and is an expert on anti-Mormon literature. I collect Mormon literature, and I believe she has the largest collection of anti-Mormon literature of anybody that I know. I always find that interesting to hear about. And also, another panel member is Ted Withers. Ted is from Auburn, Alabama. He was formerly a member of the bishopric of my ward, the Atlanta ward in the Atlanta Stake, and I can tell you from my own experience with him, he's a very good speaker. He was always energizing from the podium in our ward. It was always a pleasure to listen to him. He's an active worker in the Atlanta Temple. Since his recent marriage, he has come to live in Auburn, Alabama, so now the Auburn, Alabama ward has the blessing of his talents. We lost him. So I guess with that, if we could hear from Keith, what we're asking people to do is to speak for approximately 10 minutes about this subject and then perhaps go back to the panel. What I'm hoping we'll accomplish is a kind of a dialogue and discussion. And I hope it's going to be as informal as possible and would encourage you all to participate fully when we get to that point. Thank you very much. Keith?
Thank you.
Keith, why don't we stand up there? I think we'll have a better luck with the tape recording if we do that.
Good morning. It's a pleasure for me to be here. As you might have noticed, I'm not on the agenda. This was an invitation that came at the 11th hour, and I accepted it because I consider myself an 11th hour laborer, I'm really happy to be here. Now, the downside of me being here in the 11th hour is that I didn't have a well-prepared talk, and I thought it was going to be a more moderation, throw out some questions, and I would answer. That's the way lawyers do it. They kind of off-the-cuff kind of people. So, but I do have some thoughts, and I like to share with you, and it won't take 10 minutes to get the ball rolling, but I do have some thoughts. Let me just give you a little bit of my background that was not mentioned in the introduction. My current wife is a member from Haiti. She served a mission here on Temple Square in the mid-90s, and from my marriage to her for the past 4.5 years, I've gained some insight. I won't say a great insight, but I gained some insight on the differences in culture that we have, although we're both of the Black race. She is different from me. I call her I tell her that she has that island girl mentality, and I've learned that not all Blacks, and I knew it before, but it's really come home to me living with her that not all Blacks, even in the church, would think alike about issues regarding the church. And so that's going to be the foundation of my thoughts, basically my interaction with her. Also, I served a mission in the Caribbean. My wife was born in Haiti, joined the church in the Bahamas, and her experience in the Bahamas was considerably different from my experience when I joined the church in North Carolina some almost 23 years ago. The other foundation of my remarks will be from my experience in Puerto Rico as a missionary. Natalie's here. You want to have Natalie come up?
Sure.
I'm going to speak I don't mean to be rude, Natalie, but while you come up, I'm going to continue to talk. But as I said, I served the mission, albeit some 20 plus years ago in the Caribbean, in Puerto Rico. Had several, in fact, the majority of the converts that I came across were Black, and their experience and their outlook on things as I taught the gospel to them in these early years after the priesthood revelation was somewhat different from my feeling about things when I went through that experience about a year earlier. I joined a church in 1980. I was a senior at North Carolina State University. Two missionaries knocked on my door, and I let them in, and that began the process. And about 2 weeks later, I joined the church. And then I was accepted to BYU Law School, and I deferred that for 2 years and went on a mission to BYU. I'm one of the pillar speakers tonight, so I won't go into all that detail. I'll say that for tonight. I hope I won't, after today, won't discourage you from coming tonight, but we'll see. I ended up in the mission field 367 days after my baptism. Didn't know what I was doing, but tried to teach the truth that had affected my life. Anyway, from that perspective, the first thing I would say that about the difference, and I really believe this, is that many of those that are from Africa and from the Caribbean have had the opportunity to be politically ruled by those of their own color and own race. And so their perspective on race relations is different because, for example, take Haiti. I had the opportunity several years ago to visit Haiti. Haiti is quite a depressed country economically, socially. If you attended Martin Luther King III's talk Wednesday night, you got the statistic of how the average income in Haiti is about $200 plus dollars annually. It's a very economically depressed area, and some of you are very familiar with the political strife that Haiti has had. But this is all through black rule, and one thing my wife seems to understand that I had to learn, having grown up in the South, I'm old enough to remember having to drink out of separate water fountains. Now, it ended by the time I started grammar school, but I do remember having to drink out of separate water fountains when I was growing up in the South. And she has a better ability, and she really should be the one speaking, but she has a better ability to appreciate that sometimes the negative things and the oppression that we see is based on human nature and not so much based on race. I see that with some of my friends from Africa who've come from African nations of black rule. And so they don't tend to play, in Carmen jargon, they don't tend to play the race card as quickly whenever there's an issue. And I really felt that when I was in Puerto Rico, that it wasn't so much a black-white church issue. When I tried to teach the gospel in Puerto Rico, my wife has mentioned that several times to me about her experience in being taught in the Bahamas. And so one of the things that African Americans here in the United States seem to hang on to is the situation by which they were brought here, slavery, and they tend to make that a mixture of everything that is part of their lives. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I went through it myself. When I had to go through the missionary discussions, I remember when the missionaries came and knocked on my door, I commented to them that I didn't think they recruited black people into their church. And by then it was 1980, and they told me that I could have any privilege that a white male could have, and so I listened to them based on the merits of their doctrine and not so much on their history. But I find that some blacks have a harder time overcoming that obstacle of being subjected to slavery and the different issues associated with the United States of America. And so it prohibits them or it has a chilling effect on their ability to look at the church from a purely doctrinal standpoint. I consider myself blessed in that the Lord allowed me to overcome very quickly some of the racial issues I had with the church and the priesthood and all those things. And so I quickly grasped on into the doctrines of what made Mormonism different from what I grew up with as a Baptist, and particularly as a grandson of a Baptist minister. So that's the first thing, and I'll just throw that out for further discussion. The second thing that I will bring up is that I truly also feel that our black leaders, most of them are outside the church, but our black leaders tend to promote this chasm, I guess I can say. And I believe they tend to promote it for some of their, I know they're trying to do good for everyone, but there's some benefit, there's some personal benefit that accrues to them because of that. And I look at the different peoples of the world that have come to this area, whether they come here for religious reasons or whether they come here for economic reasons, and they tend to move forward a lot quicker. I've had to deal with, in a criminal sense, some of the families from Cambodia and from Vietnam and other areas of that world, and I'm amazed at how quickly they can come and tap into economic fortune, even though they went through a horrendous period, and many people believe that, you know, the United States was over there fighting a moral war, either on their behalf or against maybe some of the people, that some of their family members. Yet they can come here and tap into it. And I'll close by saying that two of my closest African friends came here. They both have thriving businesses. They just seem to plug right in and move forward and take advantage of what the opportunities were here, because they didn't seem to bring all that baggage over here. And I believe not only does that work in the economic sense, but it tends to work in the gospel sense. So many good African Americans that I've spoken with that are interested in the church, they even have strong feelings about the doctrinal, about the Book of Mormon or eternal families, cannot overcome some of the racial issues because of some of the baggage that's associated with the church and its relationship with blacks. And that's not to say whether it's a good or bad, but the bottom line is that the gospel is available to all people, the priesthood is available to all people, and there's much good that can be done through this church and through the priesthood. And my view is to move forward so that you can help people and not to dwell so much on the past. And I found that particularly more than any other racial group, African Americans tend to have more of a problem doing that, particularly than other blacks such as Caribbeaners and Africans. So I'll just throw it out, let the next person move on, and again, thank you for the opportunity to express my views.
Thank you, Keith. Next, we're going to hear from Ted Waters.
Thank you, Keith, for kind of setting the pace and kind of helping me to be at ease. I'm also an African American, if you haven't discovered that already. This is not a deep, dark suntan. But Keith and I had two, we grew up in, well, we were both Southerners. You were born in the South, right? I was born in the South and partially grew up in the South and finished growing up in the Midwest and finished growing up kind of around the world. Pastored for, first in the Baptist church for a few years and over 20 years in the AME church. In case you don't know, the AME church was born out of racism. I see one lady saying yes. She's shaking her head. If you don't know the history of the AME church, do yourself a favor and check it out. But it was born out of racism. It was born out of one incident at St. George's Episcopal Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. In the AME church, if you don't know, they go to the altar and kneel at prayer time. And so blacks were kneeling there, and they were literally dragged from the altar of prayer by whites and told, you have to wait until we pray before you can pray. And out of that incident, the AME church was born. Now, I don't want to deal with that issue, just wanted to throw that out to you for your consideration. I think, let's see if I'm reading correctly from the program. Why do black Americans react differently to the church than do black Africans? And I'm not an expert on this issue. I'm not an expert on this subject. This is simply from my perspective, from my viewpoint, from my experience. I think simply because we came through two different paths to where we are. Just that of itself would make us react differently and perceive and receive a different message from the church. But let me just give a little bit of how I came to know the church and how I came to accept the gospel of Jesus Christ, and we'll kind of go from there. Perhaps some questions will come from the audience that will draw some information that you are interested in. I was born in the rural South in 1930, when racism was the order of the day. You knew that if you were black, the saying was, if you're black, get back. When I grew up, if you're brown, stick around. If you're white, you're right. Think about it, to some degree, that still prevails in America and in our society today, that same concept. Dark clouds have negative connotations. If we're in a deep, dark mood, Brother King spoke to some of this Wednesday night, we're never in a deep, dark, white, deep, white mood, but it's a deep, dark mood. And so it goes on and on. I knew two things about the church when I met the missionaries. Two things. One thing that has probably maybe a twofold purpose. I was told by a person who said that he was LDS or said that he was Mormon back in the early 60s, and he said that that blacks were to be slaves, and the Bible said so. And my mind clicked. And from the early 60s until 95, late 95, when I met the missionaries, I knew this about the church, and I knew a positive thing about the church. I knew that I liked listening to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. How ironic and how powerful is the message of Satan that I could see the beauty in the music of the Tabernacle Choir and didn't have enough whatever it takes to delve into the negative message that this individual had given me about the Mormon church. But thank God, on a cold, snowy January afternoon, I just retired down in Miami, Florida, and was moving to Atlanta. And had was just bringing the last load of my stuff up from Miami, had driven up from Miami to a small town on the east coast of Georgia, spent the night and got up the next morning and drove into Atlanta and was unloading the car, and here are these two young men in suits and white shirts and ties, and so they came up and introduced themselves, and I asked if they would come back, and deep down in my mind I really didn't think they would come back. But everybody in here is LDS, right? How many LDS? You know that they came back. And they came back. And they kept coming back. Well, I thought I was a pretty sharp cookie. I had graduated with a BA degree, with a major in Bible, and a minor in English, and I thought I was a pretty sharp cookie. I thought I knew the Bible, and I said, aha, I'm going to prove them to be a cult. I know they're a cult. And so they came, and they attempted to teach me. And on one occasion, they talked about doing baptisms for the dead, and my mind clicked again. I said, aha, gotcha. You're going around being baptized for dead people and baptizing dead people. And when they showed me in the New Testament in Paul's letter to one of the churches, the lady shaking her head again, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that there is something true about this. The New Testament says the same thing that they're attempting to teach me from the Book of Mormon. This evolved into, after several months, my being baptized on the last Sunday in June 1996 in the church in an upscale community in metropolitan Atlanta. The average Sunday attendance must have been around 400, 450, and there was three or four blacks in the whole congregation. And I hope you will spread the news that the gospel of Jesus Christ is true. Having pastored black churches for over 20 years, I never felt so much love in a strange congregation, a minority, a very small minority, less than 0.1% of the congregation were minorities. But the gospel was felt. My first impression on the first Sunday that I agreed to visit them, I'm getting dry from this high altitude. Thank you. Let me talk to myself and tell me to slow down. But my first impression was, take your checkbook. They've been nice. And so the least you can do if you want to visit their congregation, put something in their offering. I was retired, so I had a couple of dollars and didn't have a lot of obligations, and so I was going to put a nice size offering in their collection. You know what happened. Nobody passed a plate. Nobody said anything about money. Nobody took a collection. And I had been accustomed to taking not one collection, but two, thank you, three, and sometimes four. And sometimes we would literally beg for money, or we would make the congregation feel guilty about not giving more money. I didn't say anything, but I thought to myself, this is kind of strange. A huge building, very well kept, a very friendly people, and they didn't take up any money. How in the world do they manage and maintain this kind of facility without money? So out of that, enough curiosity arose for me to go back again. And I took the checkbook again. And I didn't use the checkbook. Finally, the missionaries explained to me that they didn't take offerings, that the membership tithed. They put their tithing in an envelope and gave it to the bishop, and this is how the property was maintained. Are you keeping time on me? I don't want to run over
your
time.
Sleeve if we have problems.
Okay, good enough. Keep in mind, I'm a former Baptist preacher. And if you have not been to a Baptist church, I'm a former Baptist preacher and a Southerner from the deep south, a little town north of Jackson, Mississippi called Yazoo City. It takes us a little while to get wound up. But once we get wound up, we can do like the Apostle Paul did in the New Testament when he preached until the wee hours of the morning, and some young man was sitting in the window and he fell down and broke his neck, and the account says that Paul went down and laid his hands on him and brought him back from the dead and continued to preach. But I don't think I'll preach quite that long. But I have a few things I'd like to say to you. This was a most unique experience in this upscale church in metropolitan Atlanta. So I joined it, eventually consented to be baptized, and was baptized in all white clothing by a white missionary who had taught me the gospel, surrounded by white members, white men and white women and white children. And the spirit of friendliness saturated that place. I don't know how long you've been to LDS and what your experience is, but know that you have something unique. You have something that will transform the world. The prophet Joseph Smith was right when he said that you can build all the chapels that you would like, but you will never build enough to house all of the Latter-day Saints. He was right on target. Jesus was on target in the New Testament when he says, upon this rock I will build my church, and the very gates of hell shall not prevail. So in spite of, or maybe because of whatever else is going on, the gospel of Jesus Christ is moving ahead through us, through the LDS church, through you and through me and through all of us. But anyway, my situation evolved into being asked to, and I didn't know anything about a calling. They said, we want to issue you a calling. We want you to teach primary kids, 8-year-old kids, and I panicked. I had worked with adults all of my life, with blinded adults most of the time, teaching them independent living skills. Anyway, I settled down enough to finally consent to teach eight-year-olds, and guess who did most of the teaching? They did. I began to learn the Book of Mormon from these eight-year-old Latter-day Saints, and it blew me away when I found out that one of the young men had saved $30 at 8 years old to go on a mission. And my mind became an open sponge. I wanted to learn everything I could about this group of people whom I thought were a cult. And so I spent about a year or so in that ward working as a teacher for eight-year-olds and learning a little bit and a little bit more about the church. Subsequently, I moved into the inner city of Atlanta. Supposedly, I was going to move in there temporarily while I waited for housing to develop out in the area where I had joined the church. And so I moved into the inner city, but I kept going back to that same ward. And they would drop subtle hints to me and say, now you've moved out of this ward boundary. You need to move into an inner city ward. And I didn't quite catch the hint, so I just kept coming back. And so on one particular Sunday, a member of the stake presidency said to me, you've moved, and so you need to move your membership. You need to go to this particular ward. And they gave me the name of the ward and the name of the bishop and told me he was a black bishop. And I said, this is kind of strange. So they do have black bishops and black people in leadership positions. So I visited that church. And I never shall forget the first Sunday, President Parker, who is now President Parker, he was Bishop Parker at the time, he's now a member of the stake presidency, bald-headed, looked like Evander Holyfield. I think MJ refers to him, I think when she first came, MJ is another African-American whom I adopted as my spiritual daughter. She said when she first came, she thought it was Evander Holyfield. And after the fact, I thought about it, he looked exactly like Evander Holyfield sitting there. But let me just, in a nutshell, one of the most competent individuals that I've ever met, convert to the church. He married a woman who was LDS, and that would have scared me to death to marry someone who was not LDS. But she was patient with him, and one of the priesthood brethren visited him one Sunday after his family went to church, and he did not go to church. A priesthood brother came to his home and said, your family comes to church every Sunday, when are you coming? And he said, hit him like a ton of brick. And he's been committed to the church ever since. The gospel of Jesus Christ works is what I'm trying to convey to you. Anyway, I moved into the inner city, and I visited this ward and went to this Atlanta ward on this particular Sunday. Here's a black bishop, and here's a young black woman as a chorister. Got my attention. I said, this works. The gospel works here. This is not the real big thing that got my attention as a new Latter-day Saint. I kind of got entrenched into the ward a little bit, and we had three sets of elders and two sets of sisters at the time. This is inner city. Anybody ever been to Atlanta? Inner city Atlanta. Okay, so you kind of know inner city Atlanta. Atlanta is probably 50% black, 56% black. But I saw young elders and young sisters taking 2 years out of their lives, coming to Atlanta, coming to that inner city ward, going into neighborhoods that I would have been petrified. Neighborhoods where there are drugs, where there are alcoholics, where there are pimps, where there are prostitutes. And they came shift after shift after shift. And I just thank God that at the time I was not working, I didn't have a job, had a few dollars in my pocket and a little bit in the bank, and had an automobile that ran good, Ford station wagon. I could put a couple of bikes on top, two in the back end when it came transfer time, and I could take missionaries wherever. And we spent a lot of times in the ghettos of Atlanta, and some people were converted. A lot of seeds were planted. My brothers and sisters, in a nutshell, I would say to you, because of those two young men who came on that cold January afternoon when it was snowing in Atlanta, my life has been blessed beyond measure. Now I need to rephrase that. What's a future tense verb? A verb that encompasses the present tense and then goes into the future. You understand the concept I'm trying to convey to you. My life has been blessed. Let me say it this way. It is being blessed, and I know it will be blessed until Jesus comes again to change this present order. And it's all because of the LDS Church. I'm going to stop on that. I got a number of things that I jotted down when you were talking, and I will perhaps come back to those when it's question and answer. Can I stop on that note? All right, good, good.
Just for those of you that are not familiar with it, the AME Church is African Methodist Episcopal. That's what that phrase means. We're now going to hear from Renee Olson, who is a member of the Glen Ridge Ward in the Atlanta Stake.
I timed the other two just because they both told me, well, I'm not going to talk for 10 minutes. Yeah. Keith went 11 and Ted went 15. So I'm not going to stand here and tell you that I'm not going to talk for 10 minutes because I don't know. With y'all's luck, I might go 20. We was trying to get Ted wound up over there thinking, you know, good Baptist preacher with an audience and a microphone, they can talk for hours. I didn't prepare anything either. And I'm like Keith, who's our lawyer over here. I like to speak off the cuff. I'm better if I don't prepare anything. If I prepare something, I'll get nervous and flounder all over myself, which I probably will do anyway. First thing that Ted said was, as you can tell, he's African American. Well, I'm not. I'm a Black American. And the reason I don't call myself African American is because I haven't found any Africans in my ancestry yet. I found Polish. I have relatives from Germany and from England. But I haven't found any Africans yet. Not that I'm not trying. I am still tracing my genealogy. But if y'all have done, if you've found any Black in your family, you know tracing slave genealogy is hard. It's a nightmare. And I'm still working on it. But I feel like to call myself an African American would be dissing my Polish ancestry and my English ancestry and my German ancestry. So I just call myself a Black American. I have never been outside of the continental contiguous United States, so I'm content with just being a Black American. I feel too, as Keith said, that we're all, those of us who have come at this late date are the 11th hour workers. There are those like my father, Darius Gray, who joined the church before the priesthood ban was lifted. And to them, you know, God bless them, because they joined at a time when all they had was pure faith and not a whole lot else to go on. Those of us who've come in afterwards, I joined the church in 96. Matter of fact, I beat you, Ted, because I'm February of 96. That actually makes me older than you in the church. My story is also interesting. I won't give you my whole story because you don't have that much time, and it's not all that interesting. I do have a very huge cult library because, as far as I was concerned, for several years, Mormonism was a cult, and I was certified by the Southern Baptist Convention in Mormonism. Had a wonderful certificate that certified in Mormonism in big black letters. I loved it. Framed it, too, until the day I tore it up. The reason I ended up tearing it up was because I met two wonderful missionaries who obviously knew more about what they believed than I did, or at least what I thought I knew. I had always been warned to stay away from Mormons because Mormons brainwash people. You know, they starve them for 3 days, don't let them go to the bathroom, don't let them drink, you know. Actually, that Southern Baptist didn't say that. My cult training said that, but my Southern Baptist training didn't say that. I don't want the Southern Baptist to hear this and think I attributed that to them. But Southern Baptists did tell me that Mormonism is a cult and that they don't believe in the real Jesus and that we need to stay away from them because they'll brainwash you. And once they brainwash you, that's it. I mean, it's really hard to get you out once you're in. Well, I had made a habit of working on people who were Mormons and getting them out of the LDS church. I had made a habit of working on missionaries to destroy their testimonies because I felt like that was the workforce of the LDS church, was their missionary force. You destroy the missionary, you can destroy its missionary force. Therefore, the church will collapse. Little did I know. If the church didn't collapse when they killed the prophet Joseph Smith, I don't know what made me think, you know, 150 years later it was going to collapse if I got rid of a few missionaries. But I was naive. I worked in this calling for a long time. I eventually met somebody else, a sister, who kind of took me under her wing. And we didn't discuss religion a whole lot because it was kind of an off-limits subject. But because of her, I began to realize that the Mormons, they didn't try to brainwash me. I went to homemaking every month. I went with her to Relief Society when I could, but I was a good Southern Baptist, and Southern Baptists don't do things like that. Eventually, I began to see that I was being brainwashed. but it wasn't by the LDS Church. And I began to think, you know, who's doing my thinking for me? Because, you know, I'm in my late 20s. I'm a reasonably intelligent woman. I like to think. I think I'm capable of making a decision for myself. And when I began to look at things that way, then things for me began to click, and I began to realize that everything I was being told about this church and everything that people told me that this church believed was not necessarily the way it was on this side. And the missionaries asked me a very important question and said, if I wanted to learn about Southern Baptist, should I go ask my mission president what Southern Baptists believe? And I said, no, he doesn't have a clue what we believe. Ask me. I'll tell you anything you want to know about what we believe. He says, okay, then if you want to know about us, why would you ask your pastor? I went, oops. Okay. So for 2 years, I studied. Oh, I took the discussions a number of times because it was a great way to get missionaries into my home. And every time I saw that ad on TV about order your own free Book of Mormon, I called the number. And they would say, would you like us to send this to you, or would you like us to deliver this by two missionaries? I said, send those missionaries, please. I didn't ask them to come to my home. The church sent them, so they were fair game. And they always came. And we always had great talks. They didn't always come back for a repeat visit, but we always had a good initial talk, at least I thought. But I began to see that things didn't exactly add up, and I began to do my own thinking. There came a point where my best friend, my new LDS friend, she became my very best friend, told me that she was going to lose her recommend, or that her recommend would not be renewed if she continued her friendship with me, because she would be seen as a sympathizer with a known anti-Mormon. I weighed my friendship against her, my friendship with her against my certificate, and I eventually tore up the certificate and decided it wasn't worth it. The friendship meant more to me. After all, that certificate had never put food on my table, had never babysat my children, had never done anything for me other than gave me the authority to help try to destroy the Mormon church, whereas my friendship with her had done a lot. She had babysat my children at no charge. She put food on my table when I couldn't. She fed my family when I was unable. She took care of me when I was sick. She took care of my kids when they were sick. She gave me rides if I needed. She was always there for me, never asked for anything in return. Never tried to tell me the Southern Baptist Church was false. Never tried to tell me that what they were telling me was false. She just loved me. Loved me where I was at. Let me grow. Let me learn on my own. She figured I was a pretty reasonably intelligent woman. I'd figure this out sooner or later. After 10 years of wandering in the wilderness, I eventually divorced that husband, left my children, moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and tried to be a good Southern Baptist girl. But it didn't work. The Lord had other plans. By the time I moved to Atlanta, Georgia, my heart was pliable and my spirit was ready. And that was when I felt the knock on my heart. And no matter how hard I looked for a Southern Baptist church to join, the Holy Spirit kept saying, call the mission office. Call the mission office. No, I can't do that. I'm a good Southern Baptist girl. Southern Baptists don't call me in the mission offices. Call the mission office. I eventually found a Southern Baptist church I joined, but I wasn't happy. I didn't go every week. It was just as easy for me to stay home on Sunday as it was to go to church because I really didn't care. And again, I heard, call the mission office. Call the mission. And I thought, well, why would I call a Mormon mission office? That doesn't make any sense. And the Spirit said, because you're an interpreter for the deaf and I need you in my church. I said, okay, that's a good reason. You know, if you're looking for an excuse, anyone will do. Well, that was my excuse, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So I called the mission office and I said, do you have any deaf in your church? I didn't say, I'm a former Southern Baptist, I'm a former anti-Mormon, and I want to join your church. No, I was not that crazy. Matter of fact, I didn't even know what I was doing at that point. But I called and asked them, do you have any deaf? because that I could relate to. They put me in touch with a church interpreter. She in turn introduced me to several other interpreters. And the next thing I knew, I was teaching sign language and interpreting in church. Now, after 16 years of 6 years having been anti, 10 years in the wilderness, but still keeping up with Mormons and my best friend and all, I spoke perfect Mormonese. There's nothing about this church I really didn't know. And so when they said, oh, Sister Olson, or actually at that time I wasn't Olson, but they said, we're going to the temple Friday night and we'd love to have you come with us. Oh, red flags going up, going, no. No, that's okay. I don't think I can do that. And I said, well, why not? And I said, because I don't have a recommend. And they said, well, go get one. I said, yeah, right. I didn't even know what ward I belonged to. So I did not go get a recommend. I just told them, well, I'm really busy right now. You know, I don't have time to go see the bishop and all this. And finally, one day, my fiance says, you know, all I hear, and by the way, my fiance, who is now my husband, and we've been married for 7 years, wonderful man, absolutely wonderful. He is a non-member, or excuse me, he is not of our faith. He said, look, all I hear is Mormon this, Mormon that, go be one of them. And I looked at him and I said, are you serious? And he said, yes, your whole life revolves around them. Go be one. And I said, but I can't do that. I'm a Southern Baptist. He said, no, you're not. I said, yes, I am. He says, no, you're not. I said, but I've been Southern Baptist. I'm an anti-Mormon. I can't be Mormon. And he says, no. He says, you are Southern Baptist on the outside. You are Mormon on the inside. Go be one. So I got in touch with the missionaries. My discussions were fun because now I was taking the discussions for real. For the first time in my life, they were for real. Only they kind of went something like this. We'd like to tell you the story of Joseph Smith. And I said, sure, what would you like to know about him? I could probably fill you in on a few things that you don't know. 6 discussions went by really fast when you can teach them to the missionaries. But they had this one little problem, which was I hadn't told anybody that I was a non-member, including the 3 interpreters that I ran around with. We were kind of a rat pack. And so they had told me, you need to tell them you're a non-member and invite them to your baptism. And I thought, oh, that's all they need to know is I'm a fraud. I've lied to them all this time. But you know, they took it real well. I thought for sure they would hate my guts. But that's not the way things are in this church. It's not the way the people are in this church. When they found out, I told them I can't go to the temple, and they said, why? I said, because they don't give recommends to non-members. They figured it out. They forgave me. They all showed up at my baptism. Matter of fact, half of Atlanta showed up to my baptism. Everybody wanted to see the former anti-Mormon go under the water. As far as I know, I'm the only certified anti-Mormon that's ever joined the church. As far as I know, I would love to meet another one. I hate being the token everything. Gets on your nerves after a while. It's so hard to be the token. Anyway, I have never had so much peace and so much love and so much learning and growth and change and pain and everything that goes with it as I've had in this church, and it's been a wonderful journey. I was a little skeptical being put on this panel because I do not feel qualified to speak for African Americans because I are not one. Although I know some, have them in my ward, I do not feel qualified to speak on that on which I'm not. I can speak as a Black American, but that's about as good as it's going to get. So I'm hoping somebody on this panel knows something more about African Americans or Africans in particular, because that's not me. But I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
The fourth member of our panel I have to introduce to you yet is Natalie Palmer Shepherd. She's a social worker for the state of Utah, has been an active member of the church for 20 years, and in the past has been Relief Society president and is presently gospel doctrine teacher in the Genesis group and is an active temple worker at the Jordan River Temple.
Dr. Dan with Sunstone, when he was interested in me being on this panel, one of the things that interested me about it and has always interested me is the whole issue of Black Africans and Black Americans, and I'm not politically correct, so I don't say African American, but so I'll give you a little background on me, and then I will address that a little bit here from my perspective. I was born in Alabama and raised in Cincinnati, Ohio, during the racial strife of the 60s, and I was born, I grew up in an all-Black Catholic community, and when I was 19 years old, I got upset with the priest because he was given a I was at Mass one Sunday and he was putting down every religion. And I grew up in an environment where of total acceptance of people, of who they were. And I mean, I didn't have a lot of association with white people growing up, but mainly, and the only white people I knew growing up were the nuns and priests in the school and the church that I attended. However, I was still taught to respect everyone, and I was in church this particular Sunday, and he was saying, to hell with your Jehovah Witnesses, to hell with the Jews, to hell, and I just felt like, because of the way I was raised, that we did not put down any other religion or any people for, unless they were directly harmful to you, you just loved everybody. So needless to say, other than, because my whole family was Catholic, and other than going to weddings and funerals after that, I didn't go back to the Catholic Church after that. Probably 2 years later, I went to visit my mother, and she was studying with these white men, and I thought, okay, whatever. One of my issues all my life had always been the issue of how people on the American continent learned about Jesus Christ if you grew up in Jerusalem. As a child, that was my question. My grandmother used to always tell me not to ask that question, that it would all come to me one day. And so that's how I got interested in the first place in wanting to hear what these missionaries had to say. But I didn't give them, it wasn't easy for them to teach me. They would be in my mother's house, I'd go there, and once again, she was feeding some strangers because that's just who she was. She never met strangers, only future friends. And so you go to her house and there was always someone new there. And I would always say to them, I'll be right back. And I'll listen to everything you have to say, I'll be right back. And said that for like 2 months. And finally, just posed that question to them about Jesus Christ on the American continent. And the next time I saw them, they gave me this pamphlet and highlighted some things in the Book of Mormon for me to read. And I was baptized in January of 1982, and I came to Utah in September of 1982 to experience the rudest awakening of my life. Which someday, you know, when I'm finished that book, that's going to be the title. It's either going to be My Rude Awakening or I Demand to See the Prophet. I've done both. I've had that experience of both of those. As time went on, I mean, I have experienced a lot of negativeness in Utah. It's hard for me now, today, to feel it enough to express it to you. So you have to read that book when it comes out. But at that time, the experiences that I had at that time were more directed to my son, because when I came here, I came as a single parent, and my little boy was 6 years old, and the things that were directed to him were the things that were hardest for me to deal with. That's where I Demanded to See the Prophet comes in. You will have to read my book to get that story. Well, anyway, I know when I first came here, I came to this land of Zion. I was all excited. I had on the back of my brand new Chevrolet Chevette the Book of Mormon, America's Witness for Christ. And I came out of I was attending the University of Utah, and I came outside, and it was, my whole bumper on my car was all scraped up. And I thought, okay, so I'm not in the land of Zion. It took me a lot of years to learn that Zion is where the heart is. And as a result of that, and the experiences that I had when I first came to Utah, I had to reevaluate who I was and why I joined the LDS Church and where I was going from there. And I stand before you today, a woman of God, busy building the kingdom of God, and proud to say that. When I looked at this, the topic on Black Americans versus Black Africans and why they were able to convert, this is what I got out of the topic, why Black Africans were more readily joining the church and staying in the church versus Black Americans, Several years ago, in 1989, I had the opportunity to do a study on this very issue. I used to meet with Elder David B. Hayter, the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, every Thursday with a group of us, because there was a big concern as to why members, black LDS, black members, black Americans, were joining the church in southern states such as North Carolina and Georgia, and they were falling away. And that whole fellowshipping, what was happening, it became a big concern. And so we did, several of us did research on this with the permission of the church, and came back like a few months later with this whole statistical information. And what we learned was that black members in Georgia were not being fellowshipped. They were being baptized because missionaries were going out there baptizing. I mean, missionaries go out with a fever. Most of the ones I've met, they go out with a fever. That's what they're about. They're there to baptize. They believe what they're saying, and that's what their mission is. So they baptize these members, and then what people fail to recognize was that in southern states, the reason that there are Southern Baptists and there are black Southern Baptists was the very reason that still existed, that line that had been drawn so many years ago still existed. So you could convert these people to this gospel, but nobody was going out to fellowship them. What was even worse at that time in 1989 was they were actually being told not to fellowship them. So then it became necessary for, at the time, the church found it necessary to send an elderly couple out to see why, what was going on, why they were being told not to fellowship. And they did this and learned. And that elderly couple stayed in North Carolina for 6 months and came back and found that there were 950 black people baptized in that six-month period, and only 10 remained active in that six-month period. That became a big, big concern. Hopefully in the year 2003, something has changed. The difference on the flip side of that, however, is I have some friends that went to Africa, stayed there for 6 months. They were there on a business thing. They're LDS. And they learned that in Africa, and I've never been there, so this is all hearsay. In Africa, members joined the church in Africa, and they are allowed to remain who they are. They're allowed to hold on to their culture. They're allowed to bring with them into their LDS environment who they are. And I just hold on to that thought for a minute, because the flip side of it is that in America, when I joined the church, no, I didn't smoke or drink or get high or any of those things prior to joining the church. So I didn't have to give that up. But what people fail to realize, it's more to it when you take on a whole totally different culture from the culture that you have become familiar with. The struggle becomes, how do I hold on to who I am? And here I was, this angry black woman who came to Utah. I wasn't angry when I came, but I became angry after I got here. And just the treatment of my son became something that was hard for me to deal with. But the other side of it was, I was not going to let anybody take away from me what I had found, what I felt with the gospel of Jesus Christ. So then I went down to the church office building and demanded to see the prophet, and things go on from there. But today I stand before you to say, the problem that I see is that black Americans, when you join the LDS church, you're forced to assimilate into a culture that's totally different from what you're used to. And people think that that's minimal. And I'm saying that generally. People think that that's minimal, but it's not minimal for some people. For me, it was an easy transition, although, because I play gospel music every Sunday and every Saturday in my house as I clean my house. And I will sing my gospel music no matter what. And so I wasn't giving up the music, but I wasn't giving up the gospel. And I felt like they could be blended together. I had black friends several years ago who stopped speaking to me because they came to my house. It's just a funny story. I got to share it with you real quick. It was a Sunday, and I was playing the Edwin Hawkins Choir, and I was going up yonder. I was having a good time. And they came to visit, and I wouldn't turn off my music. And they wanted to know why I didn't have the Tabernacle Choir on. And no more offense, my brother. But for me, that's not what got me where I needed to be spiritually. And so, but they stopped speaking to me. These people, they stopped speaking to me, and they said that I was too black for them. And I was trying, and these were not white people, mind you, okay? These were black people that were two shades darker than me, so I was still trying to figure out how was I too black for you. I was, hopefully, you recognize me as a black woman who was proud of who I am and could still be LDS and listen to gospel music. And you guys are so funny. And so the problem, as I saw it, was had nothing to do with me. It wasn't my problem. Let me tell you, speed forward with me, if you will. This was several years ago. These very same individuals 2 years ago came to me and said, we're moving to Georgia. And we want to know what you think about us moving to Georgia. And I said, I mean, I don't care if you move to Georgia. They stayed in Georgia 2 months. They stayed in Georgia 2 months because they could not deal with, there were too many black people in Georgia. I'm having a hard time with this. Either you have a testimony of what you believe in and you have a pure witness of Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, or you don't. Because if you do, then you can assimilate and be comfortable wherever you are. The issue here that we're addressing today, though, is two-sided for me. It's because we have to allow, when I served as the Genesis Relief Society president, and I served in that capacity for 5 years, I visited sisters from Logan to Springville, Utah. I tried to understand why they had gone inactive, most of them were black sisters in the church, why they were inactive, what made them go inactive. And I think this is something that needs to probably be delved a little deeper in on a whole different level than I have. But most of these people felt not a part of their wards or their community where they were. They had all come from Georgia, Ohio, like myself, Chicago, different places, and they'd come here to the land of Zion expecting to be embraced. And some of them were embraced. Some of them, however, were always constantly reminded of how black they are. The sad thing about it is that I've met a lot of Africans who have come from, black Africans who have come from Africa to Utah, and they come, I was going to say in packs, and I hope that's not insulting, but they do. They come, there's a lot of them, and they come together, so they're able to hold on to that very same culture that they had in Africa. Whereas we come like me, I came with just a five and a half year old little boy, and you need something familiar with you. Sometimes you just need to be able to talk to people who have been where you've been and know where you're going. Because unless you know where I've been, you can't even tell me where I'm going. And so that's what I find happens a lot, is that people, black Americans, join the church. They don't feel the fellowship that someone is actually relating to them. I mean, it's kind of deeper than the music. I mean, I sit in sacrament meeting and I'm bored to death half the time with the music. But it's deeper than the music. It comes from fellowshipping. We talk a lot about fellowshipping in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and you need to fellowship people. It's not okay to be able to say, well, I'm not letting anybody take away my salvation. I'm not having a problem with this, so why should I bother to try to fellowship that individual who's fallen away from the church? Because we should, because it's our job. And if we talk about why black Africans stay stronger and more joined each and every month, week, daily, and black Americans are like, time out. And it has a lot to do with when I walked in and Keith was talking, and we talked about the racial issues in this country. And when you go to other countries that are predominantly black, ruled by blacks, they did not face the same racial issues that we faced. I met women when I was Genesis Relief Society president who came from Trinidad, who came from the Bahamas, who came from different places, and they came to Utah, and they had never even experienced racism until they came here. And I'm not saying Utah is the only place that's racist. I mean, that's a whole other issue, but happens to be where they came when they came to this country. So they experienced that racism. A lot of them fell away from the church. So what I have noted and understand is that we have to remember, when we talk about cultural responsiveness and being able to relate to people on their level with their culture, they need to be allowed to bring who they are into who they want to become and be accepted as who they are with the knowledge they have. Because the reality is, even if we weren't talking religion here, the reality is for each and every one of us in this room, the only way we learn about each other and each other's culture is that we become friends with each other and we share that knowledge. Because none of you white people sitting here will know anything about a black person other than what you watch on TV, which is scary in and of itself, unless, of course, you make it your business to befriend a black person and find out who they are. And ironically, surprisingly, at the end of the day, you learn, hey, this is a person just like me. And this person feels just like me. And hey, their blood is red. So the thing about it that we have to do as a country, as a you know, even if we take the religion piece aside, which I don't know if I'm allowed to do that in this panel, but even if you take the religion piece aside and you deal strictly with who we are as individuals on an individual basis, and you say, hey, what broadens our horizons? My children I raised to be well-rounded individuals. How could they possibly be well-rounded if I am training them to be so narrow-minded that they don't look anywhere but straight? And if we all do that, then we don't learn anything about anybody. And we don't know that this sister here could feel just the same pain that you're feeling, and that we all together can comfort each other. And that's all I have to say on it, and thank you for having me.
What I'd like to do now is briefly go back through the panel one more time in the same order that we heard from them earlier, just for any reaction or comment they may have heard from some of the others. And I want to set the table a little bit with a kind of a question or comment, I guess. I'm in the Atlanta ward in the Atlanta stake, which when I came into that ward, we had a black bishop who's now first counselor in the stake presidency. Our turnout is pretty consistently around half and half, black and white, with a smattering of others. And it's a ward that I particularly like. It's the first time I've had an experience with a ward mixed like that. And my observation of it is that people, there's a kind of a critical mass there that I think lets people be comfortable. At least that's my reading of it. And I think probably because of the racial breakdown, people seem to make more of an effort to not to get along, to not have problems come up. There really is a good spirit about the ward. It's a congregation that I particularly like. And I think some of the comments that we've heard sort of raise the issue of how much of what we do in the Mormon world is gospel and doctrine, and how much of it is maybe cultural baggage that we've carried with us. And I suspect everybody will mention that a little bit. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Keith. Yeah, that'd be better. I think they're tape recording, and that's the only way it gets on. And then we're going to try to get to some questions.
I'm not going to give you any promises on time here, but I did take some notes on a couple things that were said by the others. I'll be honest, which I have a different perspective from Natalie and Renee, mainly based on what I heard them say. But my first marriage was an interracial marriage. I served as a bishop of a, probably at the time, the most, I was told by a general authority, the most diverse ward in the continental United States. 1989, I was called a bishop. I'd only been a church 9 years. I'd only been off my mission less than 6 years. And so my perspective is different, because when I became a black bishop, I could, the black part of being a black bishop didn't matter. I was just a bishop. I didn't know anything, trying to do what bishops do. And I'll be very honest with you. It's not a racial issue to me. It never will be. And that experience as a bishop taught me that. It's about people trying to live the gospel. And when you put the racial issue in there, you're missing the boat, in my opinion. Okay? Because it doesn't matter what the struggle is. Okay? People come here and they're struggling, and the struggle is a racial challenge. Other people, the struggle is being single. Other people, the struggle is dealing with their sexual preferences. But people are struggling, and they're struggling over something. And God told us very clearly that we're going to be tested, and we're going to be tested on the thing that matters most to us. And I've seen that so many times. And what I did when I was a bishop, and issues came up, whether it was smoking or sexual preference, or because you got to remember I was in San Francisco, and that was an issue. I mean, I'm not even going there, but I'm just telling you that was an issue. I was in San Francisco, and there was a racial issue, and there was all these things. But what I counsel people to do is, and Matley brought it up, is that we have to hold on to our culture, and some people try to hold on to the culture. And that's fine, because I don't think the gospel ever tried to make me change who I was, okay? And I think that's the problem here. I think that's the problem here when I say Salt Lake and in a predominantly Mormon culture. They want everybody to change. They want the person that comes here from Brazil to be like them. Okay? You don't see that in other places. But see, what I taught people and what I believe and what I teach my children is that the gospel requires you to lose who you are. That's what the Lord said, you got to lose yourself. Didn't he say that? I mean, am I misquoting him? He said, you got to lose yourself and then you'll find yourself. Okay, and so you have to give up who you think you are to become who the Lord wants you to be. And my feeling has been that those who are more acceptable of that process, like me, I had to give up who I was in terms of wanting to live with my family because I've been in Utah for most of my adult life now. But I had to give up. I didn't give up who I am. I'm still the same Keith Hamilton I was 40 years ago. Okay? The core me. But, I want to live in the South. I want to die in the South. I might die in Utah based on what the Lord wants me to do. But I'm willing to do that. Okay? And that's what I'm trying to get across today. The other thing is fellowshipping, and that's a key part. And any of you that are familiar with some of the things that the leaders, both female and male leadership of the church, have said, is that fellowshipping is an issue. It's not just a racial issue. It's not just something that applies to black people. It applies to everybody. It applies to everyone in this church, and that's a problem. And so, again, if you just target one piece of it, I think you're missing the boat. I mean, we as Latter-day Saints have to do a better job as Latter-day Saints. I don't care what color you are. We all do. I have to. And so what I want to leave with this group, and again, I'm not trying to diminish the things that are said, but again, from my experience, some of the issues that black Americans, African Americans, have over some of the smaller things, like... And I call them smaller things because they're appendages to what the gospel's about, as was brought up. Blacks from the Caribbean, blacks from Africa, whether they're here in packs, as Natalie said, or whether they're just here with their wife and kids, or whether they're here by themselves. I'm not going to go with that pack thing, they seem to not get caught up in some of these smaller things of the gospel. And so, and I'm a former bishop, so I hope you're not surprised with what I'm saying. But, we need to teach the gospel in its purity. And we need to help people understand that why they joined the church. See, because when people were joining the church, they weren't joining the church because of the music, because they might not have known what kind of music was being played. See, the missionaries don't go. I've never been in a missionary discussion where someone taught what music is played in a sacrament meeting. Okay, I've never been in a missionary discussion. I've taught and received where some of these side issues are taught. Okay, what they do is they teach the gospel doctrines in its purity, and that's what brings people to church. And then some of these other things drag them off. I'm gonna close with this. I've been associated with the I Am Jane play since its inception in 2000. I've been associated with that, and I've done many performances. I've played the role of Isaac James, Jane's husband. I know very well the story of Elijah Abel and what he went through. Many of you are familiar with Jane Manning James went through. But see, what I take from those stories, and I can tell you, I've been mistreated as a black member of the church by both blacks and whites in North Carolina and in Utah. But I haven't come close to being treated the way Jane Manning James was treated. And I haven't come close to having things withheld from me the way they were withheld from Elijah Abel. But what I learned from their stories is, despite all that, they died true to the gospel. And that tells me there's something more than all this other stuff. There's something within the gospel itself that kept those two people true to the gospel, regardless of how they were treated. And see, that's my focus, that's my mark, and I'll talk a little bit about that tonight. But that's my focus, and I think that we can do a better job in trying to take away the falling percentages among blacks in the church. If we can help people, help them recognize why the church was important to us, if they're second generation members, or help remind people why they joined the church in the first place. And I'm not trying to denigrate the racial issue. It's a serious issue, but I think the answer is, as Natalie stated, and that is people, Latter-day Saints, particularly in this forum, learning how to treat other people regardless of who they are. If you start treating everybody else like a son or daughter of God, then it won't matter whether they're white or black or Russian or Chinese or whatever. And we need to learn how to do that. And once we do that, then you'll see some of these issues about how a black's treating his sacrament and in his ward and all that will start to dissipate, because you have children of God treating other children of God the way God would have them treated. And that's what I'm striving to do, and I hope you'll join me in doing that.
That brings us back to Ted Widers.
Thank you, Ken. I'm not wearing a jacket, so pull my imaginary coattail if I get long-winded. We could license this brother to preach. Yes, amen. We are complex individuals. This little 3-pound computer up here between our ears is programmed with literally billions of pieces of information. It's there. And it causes us to act and react and behave in whatever way we do that. It's there. And I can erase it and reprogram it. And you have the opportunity to erase it and reprogram it. I want to be very brief and just kind of respond to some comments that were made by the other three panelists. I feel a sense of honor to have the opportunity to just kind of share some of my thinking and some of my experience, just kind of a small smattering of what I've experienced. And in my comments, I did not mean to indicate nor to imply or to have you believe that I've not encountered some racism in the church. But you were right on target. The gospel of Jesus Christ is stronger than anything. Somewhere, I think, is recorded that it's stronger than the cords of death. Catch the spirit of what I'm saying. The gospel of Jesus Christ is powerful. I think Nelson Mandela would testify. The gospel of Jesus Christ kept him hopeful and alive and good-spirited for 20-plus years while he was imprisoned, simply because he wanted to do something to better South Africa. And that's just simply one individual case that I can think of. Natalie, I love gospel music too, and I didn't mean to imply that I do not love. I was born with gospel music. I got gospel music in my feet and in my elbows and in my bones, and I too am bored sometimes. I think Ken and I have discussed this, and a number of us who were in the Atlanta ward discussed that it would be much peppier if we could put some gospel. And you know, here's what it boils down to. You know, culture is a two-way street, or a three-way street, or a four-way street. I have some rich culture that if I could share with you, you might be surprised. And if we could share our cultures with each other, I suspect, and I really believe deep down in my heart, that it would run down over the earth and have a transforming effect that the stuff that we are doing now can't possibly do. Let's say a couple of other things about some things that were said. Who talked about? Somebody talked about racism. Keith talked a little bit about racism. But here's what we need to focus on in my small way of thinking. Forgiveness is a two-way street, and there need to be some forgiveness. Not if there is racism, because racism is alive and well and functioning in all of the United States of America. I don't know about other countries, but it is alive and well. Don't fool yourself. Back in the late 50s or early 60s, Dr. Benjamin Mays, former educator from the Atlanta area, wrote a book called The Gentle People of Prejudice. If you haven't read it, you ought to do yourself the favor of reading it. You see, racism is usually we usually point southward when we think of racism. Racism was born in the South, but it permeated the whole continental United States. Dr. May's book was called The Gentle People of Prejudice. You don't need to buy a copy, go to the library. If I had the ISBN number, I'd give it to you. You'd go online and read it online. But it, it paints a good picture of what was going on in America and what is going on in America. But the scriptures speak to us, and in the Book of Mormon, for example, we are taught that forgiveness is a two-way street, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but I'm going to be pretty close. But our Father in Heaven says, I will forgive whom I will, but it is required of you to forgive everybody. So this says to me, if I've experienced some racism, I feel sorry for that person, and I forgive them for being small-minded enough to not know that I am a child of God, washed in the blood of Jesus Christ, saved and sanctified because of what Jesus did when he went to the cross. And then if you don't want to believe it, from the Book of Mormon, in the New Testament, it is right at the end of the Beatitudes. We find a passage, and Jesus said, let's see if I can read my writing here. He says, if you don't forgive those who trespass against you, neither will your Father which is in heaven forgive you. My goodness, Ray Charles could understand that, and Stevie Wonder would just jump up and clap his hands and shout for joy. I mean, it seems that plain to me. Fellowshipping is a two-way street. I don't know what I mean when I wrote that down, but I wrote that down that fellowshipping is a two-way street. And, I wish I could just talk about blacks from different cultures. I had the opportunity to spend a year in Kingston, Jamaica, and I had white friends who came there, and they said they never really understood racism until they came and everybody in the bank was black. The whole immigration force was black. When they got off of the airplane or off of the ship, everybody in charge was black. And all of the officials, the storekeepers, et cetera, were black. And so obviously when those people come here, somebody said they've never experienced racism. So they act and they react differently. They conduct themselves differently. I imagine they are shocked when they come here and somebody make them think that because they're black, they're different. Let me leave that alone, but I wish this would take a whole session just to deal with this issue of blacks from other cultures. Let me see, I think I'm going to have to close on that. Racism was not, and I kind of alluded to that already, not an LDS issue. Don't let anybody dupe you into believing that it's just an LDS issue. It is an American issue. And again, I refer to Dr. Benjamin May's book, The Gentle People of Prejudice. The priesthood band, I found out about it. Let me slow down. I'm almost through. But I found out about it after I was well entrenched into the LD Church and was convinced and committed to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I was going to express myself in the LDS Church. And so it really didn't have too much effect on me that it had been withheld. Because during the same time frame, in every other facet of society, hear me clearly, racism was alive and well and functioning and kicking, if you please. You understand what I'm saying? Dr. Martin Luther King said this one, and I'm going to close on that note. He said the most segregated hour in America is 11 o'clock Sunday morning. Catch the spirit of what he was saying. Thank you so much for the opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer some questions.
Thank you. Renee, we have about 5 minutes. If you would speak to us, and then hold 5 minutes for Sister Shepherd.
Well, I won't take 5 minutes because there was supposed to be time for questions. But some people didn't leave time. But that's all right. That's all right. Because they said what really needed to be said. And there's not a whole lot I can add to what they did say because I think they've said it all. That was wonderful. And I did appreciate their comments. I will say this, though. You know, it was, and I even forget who said it, but it was talking about getting to know each other, sitting down and finding, I think it was Natalie, said, if we just sit down and talk, we'll find out we're not all that different. Like, this is my good friend right here, Julie. She's been my roommate for FAIR, which is Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research. We hold an annual conference ourselves, and our conference was last week. This woman for 2 years has roomed with me. She's found out we're not all that different. Now, she might keep me up at night, and I might want to kick the crap out of her because I lost sleep, but all in all, at the end of the day, we find out we have a lot in common. I'm staying with this lady right here. She's been my host for a week. She's probably ready to throw me out now and send me home. But she's also found out, as has her family, we have a lot more in common. We have a lot more the same than we have different. Yesterday, I just met this sister back here in the red hair, and I don't even know her name. I forgot your name. I'm sorry. Colleen. I met her yesterday in a different talk and found out, you know what? We have a lot in common, don't we? We have a lot the same.
And she might have looked at me before and thought, oh, that's a black woman. I don't know what she thought before. And it doesn't even matter, because now, you know what? I look at her and I see, hey, that's my sister. We got a lot in common. We're friends. And I think if we just take the time to do that, we'll find out that we do have a lot in common. We have a lot we can share. For those who are interested, and I don't know if you have seen these flyers being handed out for the 11th Hour documentary being done by Rob Foster, raise your hand, Rob, only black man out there, and Richard Dutcher. They are putting together this documentary. If you want to help, if you really believe that we can help to educate people and eradicate racism, and I think we can. I don't know that we can get rid of it altogether, because as long as there are human beings, there will be racism. There will always be some jerk on the earth who thinks his race is better than everybody else's. We can't help that. That's stupidity. So we deal with it. But if you want to help them to get rid of it, then help to support their project. Okay, get one of these flyers. If you don't have one, we have them up here. Rob's got tons of them. Get one of these. Support the project, okay? And together, as Latter-day Saints, and we can educate Latter-day Saints, we can educate those who are not of our faith, because it doesn't matter, Latter-day Saint or not, racism knows no color. Prejudice knows no color. But together, if we work together, we can make a difference. Thank you.
Now some comments from Natalie Shepherd.
Okay, now I have to leave, actually, so I have to bring my stuff up here with me, because I have my coworker here with me, and we just came from court on a different case. We're social workers. And but I just wanted to say that it's an interesting thing. Keith and I were just sitting there, and the reality is that black and white Americans have much more in common than black Americans have with black Africans, just by the nature of being Americans. And the common element that we have there, and I, you know, you can go many places and hear talks on racism. We can talk about racism all day and all night, and everybody has an opinion. But we know what opinions are like. but the bottom line is that we are all children of a loving Father in heaven. So no matter what your religious denomination is, no matter where your point of reference comes from, we are all brothers and sisters. And if we treat each other accordingly, how much better this world will be. I look at my children. I have children in age from 27 years old, and my youngest child is 4. Okay, so I was crazy, but it's neither here nor there. My 4-year-old, my change of life baby, as I call her, is the best thing that ever happened to my husband and I. What I do know, I watch my children, I watch their struggles, I remember my own struggles, and I want them to know, and what I want to instill into each and every one of them, is that you are a child of God, and what you need to be busy doing is building His kingdom. And the only way that works is that we unify. We become unified together in doing that. And this is something I'm going to leave you. I wrote this when I was a senior in high school. To forge an unbreakable chain of unity, stronger than a chain of slavery once forged to separate us. That's what we need to be about, each and every one of us. Thank you.
We have a very few minutes for questions, if anybody would like to pose them to our 3 surviving panel members. Yes?
I have a question about fellowshipping, and you were mentioning fellowshipping goes both ways. I know sometimes I do it well and sometimes I don't. I don't want someone to feel glommed onto because they're new or because they're different. Is that a feeling from somebody?
I'm going to repeat the question for the benefit of the tape recording. Do you have any comments on not creating situations where people feel glommed onto or attached as in an over-effort to fellowship?
Let me answer it this way. The only way I know how to answer it, if you talk to 10 different people of color, you will probably get close to 10 different answers. To me, it doesn't matter. I'm still strongly of the opinion that it's a two-way street. When I went to that all-white congregation, it was also my responsibility to fellowship somebody who didn't know me and who had some negative concepts about me, and I shared some good culture with them.
Let me just say this. If you find somebody that, don't approach somebody because it's somebody of color. Approach somebody because you have something in common. Hey, you got children, they got children, you've got a friendship. You got something to build on. If there's something to build on, they won't feel glommed onto, they're going to feel loved.
I'm going to show Renee. I can be brief. I think you just have to be natural, okay? Be yourself. If you're shy, then you'll be shy and just kind of work through it. But you just have to be natural, because I can tell you from my personal experience, I think they'll agree. Black people know when someone's coming to them because it's a project. We know it, and we can feel it, and I don't know if it's an inborn thing, but we know it. We know when you're not sincere about it, and that's the worst thing you can do to us. And so I think you just be yourself and be friendly.
Yeah, we know, because it's part of that program.
That's right.
Yes, automatic response.
That's right.
Do we have any other questions? Yes.
You said it wasn't about race. I say it is about race, and denial is futile, and it's obvious. When African-American gospel music is not seen as reverent by white folks in a predominantly white church as healthy, sacred, worship, praise, music, that is racism in the deepest level. Music is a language, and it's a record of a history, a heart and soul and a spirit of expressing the human condition. Europe cannot and does not represent my plight. You said something about doing your job as a woman. Do you remember?
Yeah.
What is your job?
Can I respond? When I say I don't think race is an issue, I didn't say it was irrelevant. I just said it's not the issue. The issue is being sons and daughters of Jesus Christ, of God. That's what we're here for, and that's your job. See, if you're a representative of Jesus Christ, then your job is to represent Jesus Christ. That's what it means to me. Okay. As far as the music, the church has policies. Let me give you a good example. When I was bishop, I had a group that wanted to play a guitar in sacrament meeting. The church had a policy against it. And I don't know if they have a policy against music, against gospel music. I've never heard of that. Okay, and I've actually had people come to my ward. I've actually sponsored people singing gospel music. So I don't know the answer to your question. All I know is that the church has policies, and I think a person's missing. It's just my opinion. Okay, and I respect yours. No, what I'm saying is, this. That we're here to carry out the gospel message. And I think that if we allow whether or not we can sing gospel songs in sacrament to discourage us from carrying out Christ's message, then we're missing the boat. That's all I'm saying.
But and what wait, whose message are you carrying, since you are carrying a message of music? It seems to me there's comfort
in
carrying the European method of Christ's music, but not comfort in carrying the people that you identify or rather.
No, what I'm saying is this. What I'm trying to say is this, that Christ's message is within the music. Christ's message isn't the music.
I agree.
Okay,
with
and so.
I'm just saying that why can't it be done through African American gospel music and European?
I'm not saying it can't. I'm not saying it can't. But what I'm saying and what I want and what I'm teaching my family, and you can accept it or not, what I'm telling my family is, if you go somewhere and it's not, stay there anyway, because the gospel's there. You understand the difference? So it may be better to have it. But if you go somewhere and it's not there, then stay anyway and sing the white songs and do the right things. Because the gospel's there, and that's what you're there for. You're not there for the music. That's an add-on, and it'll
but
be great.
Why is the white music there?
I don't know why the white music's there, but it's irrelevant. Okay, you're there to learn the gospel so you can bless others.
I'm just saying for equal representation. Well, there are blacks and whites there. Why can't the music represent?
I don't know. I don't know. It's not. What I'm saying is, don't. And you don't get hung up on it, because you're there for a higher purpose. Now one day, I don't know if you're there or not, but one day the music might be there.
I ain't about to be. I'm not there.
Okay, but
I'm not in conflict with my worship.
I'm not either. And that's all I'm telling the people is don't, because, you know, there's some things within the LDS church and the gospel that are worth more to sacrifice. I mean, I miss the music. I tell you, I miss the music.
But doesn't that put you in conflict?
No, because I don't. I'll keep missing the music as long as
but
what
you
I.
You have to give up something. See, we, the white brethren
are. I'll let Renee answer that.
Stay here. Stay here.
Everybody gives up.
I want to specifically answer her question because I asked the specific question that she's asking, and that's why when I heard it, I was like, oh, yes, please, I want to respond to this. I was told that we can't have black music in the LDS church because